The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, the culture and traditions of ancient Egypt have long captivated history students, but one part of its history may have been swept under the rug. On today's program, we'll explore opium use in ancient Egypt and how the drug was used by people of all classes, including the pharaohs. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Opium use in ancient Egypt was likely a part of daily life. Researchers inspecting alabaster vessels, thousands of years old, have examined remnants of a brown substance with indicators that it may have once been opium. Vessels similar to those recently examined by researchers were found in King Tut's tomb more than a century ago, but their purpose was not widely revealed. The Best of Our Knowledge's Madeline Reynolds spoke with Andrew Coe, a museum scientist at the Yale Peabody Museum, to learn more.
So, to kind of establish what we're talking about here, can you talk a little bit about opium and how it was maybe used in ancient civilizations for medicine and maybe even spiritually, religiously, and, you know, what it looks like?
Sure. Usually my starting point when I talk to, you know, people like my parents' friends is I usually start by referring to aspirin because, of course, that's something people presumably are much more familiar with. And it's interesting, too, because the lab that we're in at Yale West Campus was owned by Bayer. So it's only fitting that we talk about aspirin. And as almost everyone knows, Bayer pioneered the aspirin. And aspirin, of course, comes from the bark of a tree, right? And there's always those interesting questions. And that's why I start with aspirin, because at least for me, I'm not sure if this is for the average person, you got to start asking, who was the first person to take that bark, right? And do whatever they did, it fall accidentally into a pot and they're like, this feels better. I mean, who knows? But that's the nature of discovery and just survival and the idea that, you know, we are living this life, this physical, typically very difficult life for a relatively short amount of time. And how do we get through it? And I don't think opium in that sense is that different from aspirin. So we have some ideas, and there's still some debates about where did the poppy plant come from. But regardless of all that, at some point, someone saw this also aesthetically pleasing flower and said, well, there's this other thing with it. There's always a context to these ways we interact with the natural world and in our all physical ailments and things like that. So at some point, thousands of years ago, somebody saw this latex coming out of a capsule and said, wow, this does certain things. And what's fascinating to me, and these are like I mean, I like studying royal purple dye. I love studying things like, you know, like perfumes, but typically those things aren't all that relevant, to be honest, today. The fact that we know from iconography that these poppies existed. But here's the interesting thing to me is people always ask also at these, you know, these tea parties or whatever, isn't it a fraught topic? But to me, it fascinates with the way we receive it today, right? Because it has so much baggage, right? And people, you know, there's this kind of a taboo about the opioid crisis, which I'm not making light of. That's a serious thing, of course. But I found it fascinating that even though there is, in my opinion, abundant evidence for opium use, there is clearly kind of aversion to talk about it. And we don't want to get into the roots of archaeology and who were the people who maybe that culturally, you know, was it Victorian, you know, was it Puritan, whatever. But of course, the linchpin of the study was kind of stumbling upon this really interesting vessel in the Yale Babylonian collection. And I also, the other story I tell is people always say, well, you find these things, it's so interesting, how do you do it? I'll be honest with this piece because it's what we call a legacy vessel. It's been around for over 100 years. It was gifted to Yale that long ago, and I've presented this jar and the contents, the last year or two. So this takes a while to do the study thoroughly. So people, word was out on the street, but for me, what's interesting about this, and this gets to the part about King Tut, is it's not just the one jar, but I went back to that first study, as you might know. And in that study, it was a much more humble situation. It wasn't for kings, it was just a merchant family, probably. So that got me thinking, this isn't just for royalty, but this is a what we would it's so much more relatable. These kind of remains are often not studied because, to be honest, in thousands of years, people will probably study our presidents and those kind of people, but people like us will be lost to history. So, in essence, this first study I ever did, it's people like you and me, Madeline. It's like it's our families, and they have the Bayer in their toiletry kit. Except back then, they didn't discover this bark of a tree yet, so they're using opium. We have yet to discover so much. My guess, and I haven't even published this yet because we don't have enough data yet, is they must have had a relatively sophisticated understanding of how to utilize it. Because what I mean by that is it wasn't like we know today, like a pill, like Vicodin. I mean, they clearly probably diluted it. They did all kinds of other things to it. They knew how to use it. But that's really fascinating to me as well, because that again goes to what I'm saying, is that this isn't some pie in the sky thing, like a last resort thing. Like, this might kill me, but I'm gonna try it because I'm in so much pain. It's clear that they've used this for some time, and they've calibrated it enough. Another fascinating piece that'll come out with the study of this first earlier tomb is there's a young mummy in there, right? So it's a kind of a kin group or family group, probably extended family, and they each had one of these vessels with opium in it, and there was one for the little person. So again, to show that it's relatively safe, and it's a part of, this is where wording gets tricky. As you might know, it went from, people perhaps saying opium didn't exist, there's no way they used it, to now when I said it was probably a much more normal or regular, however, I choose my words carefully because I say those things, the next thing you know, out in the news feed, it was incredibly widespread and everybody was on opium, 24/7. It wasn't necessarily that. Our evidence doesn't point to that, but I'm just saying that it was still probably special because it's not that easy to get, so you reserve it. So that's where it probably differs from aspirin. I don't want to keep on debating about whether opium existed back then or not.
You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. If you're just joining us, Madeline Reynolds has been speaking with Andrew Coe, a museum scientist at the Yale Peabody Museum, to learn about ancient Egyptian opium use.
So I'm curious about the vessel that you specifically looked at. So I'd love to know what that vessel looked like, what it was made out of. There were some inscriptions on it. So
Sure.
I'd love for you to kind of describe that.
That's what makes it such a special piece, and why what first attracted attention to it at a place like Yale over 100 years ago. There's less than 10 of these in existence, at least intact. Some would say less than five or five-ish, so certainly less than a dozen. It's a vessel that's around half a liter in volume inside. So to give a perspective, it's like a largish soda bottle, something like that, of the contents. So, there's a reason why I mentioned that, which I'll talk about in a second. The vessel's made out of what we, for better or worse, call Egyptian alabaster. That's kind of the colloquial term that people have always used. There are statues and pharaohs used it's a very pretty kind of stone, but it's calcite. And there are several, but especially one very famous quarry in Egypt, ancient Egypt, that they utilize for millennia to mine it. So the other interesting thing about Egyptian society, as you might know, is that it's a very detailed and particular culture in terms of its practices at a certain level, at least at a more elite level. So if you go to Luxor, everything just looks ancient Egyptian, as people probably gather, maybe missing some color, but the stone, the lot of inscriptions and carvings. And you walk in Luxor and you look in the back, and for the average eye, it'll just look like a pharaoh in a famous pose. For those who are a little bit more attuned to what's going on there, they'll realize that that's actually Alexander, who was Macedonian Greek. So again, it wasn't like someone like Alexander came in and said, we're going to make everything Greek now. There's something about ancient Egypt that encourages people to become Egyptian more than trying to make Egypt more like them, right? So there's that conservative factor. So I got questions about that. Well, what does this tell us about ancient Egypt? There's these other particular things about when we study ancient Egypt. Usually people mean the golden pharaonic periods, right? So around 3000 to 1000 BCE or something like that. And this jar comes from the 5th century. In the 5th century, ancient Egypt wasn't necessarily like the super, it was still a very important area because of the Nile River and its riches, but it wasn't kind of an alpha player at that point in the 5th century, right? As you might know. So at that point, it was the Achaemenid Persians. And of course, we know them from movies, for better or worse, like the movie 300 and their interactions with the Greeks, so on and so forth. So this is over 500 years after the time of King Tut, but the vessel type, the calcite jar, the volume, the shape of it, it's very ancient Egyptian. But there's a twist on it, right? It was a very so they took this genre in the 5th century, the Persian rulers and the half brother who was the governor satrap of Egypt, so kind of a de facto pharaoh of sorts, a local pharaoh. And they made it very particular using hieroglyphs and other scripts, inscribed the great king's name of Xerxes, right? That's not an Egyptian king. It's an Achaemenid Persian king, again famous from movies like 300. And it appears that as a part of the structure of this vast empire, just as even in the United States, like there's certain areas that are known for certain things. You go to New Orleans, there's certain food there, Seattle, the fish market, et cetera, et cetera. So you have this vast empire. Egypt was known for certain things for many, many centuries. And they seem to, of course, they had Egyptian alabaster. You have their connection with opium. Great debates about whether opium was actually grown in Thebes. Regardless of whether it was, Egypt was kind of a nexus point as a huge market, as being a superpower. Historically, in ancient times, they would get access to, like, just as for better or worse, Americans, we can get access to things like Vicodin and Percocet pretty easily, right? Those probably something like that. So, a very rare vessel, and we don't know because they're so rare how many were made, how many were commissioned, for how long. What we do know, based upon the evidence that exists, that it was at least this vessel, and I would posit the opium that was the main feature of it. The vessel is just a container. We forget that sometimes as we look at these vessels at museums. So what I would postulate is, this is the nuance that I'm getting at, not just the mere existence of something like opium. I'm guessing, especially because of the nature of this vessel, you're dealing with the great king, arguably the most powerful and richest person in the world at the time, in Xerxes, that this is the purest, best opium, whatever that means, you can get, right? So this does differ. So that's where some people say, well, I don't believe that kings later on would use the same opium that a more humble merchant family would use. I'm not saying that. It's just opium. I'm not saying the quality is the same. I'm not saying the nature. It's also separated by, 1,000 years. So I'm guessing that's what made it wasn't just a mere. This is a point I didn't make, actually. You're the first person, Madeline, that I'm guessing it's the quality also of the opium in there that made this special. Because people are just fixated, oh my gosh, opium. That's what made this. It wasn't just the opium. It seems that fairly average people could get opium, probably in much lesser qualities and quantities, so on and so forth. So you had half a liter of really good opium, probably, whether it's 50 of these jars, 10 of these jars, packaged in Egypt and then sent to the heartland of the empire in modern day Iran, that region, Babylon maybe, so Iraq, Mesopotamia. And then from there, it was then seemingly distributed to all your favorites. So because we find them in the local regional elites, like the Tomb of Mausolus, the very king that we get the term mausoleum from, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. So we find one of these vessels, at least one of these vessels, in the Tomb of Mausolus. So putting these pieces together, it seems that there was kind of this really this specialized industry, or whatever you want to call it, of processing opium. They packed in these really pretty vessels, which, I mean, these vessels today are priceless, or whatever you want to call it, on the antiquities field. But that was, again, just a wrapper. It's what was inside that was exceedingly special, and then that was sent, and then probably redistributed by the great king to his most loyal subjects, and that's how we get our vessel at Yale, as it came from Mesopotamia.
This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. If you're just joining us, our Madeline Reynolds has been speaking about the use of opium in ancient Egypt with Andrew Coe, a museum scientist at the Yale Peabody Museum.
Why would King Tut want to be buried with, you know, these vessels that possibly contain opium in them? I mean, there's been studies done decades and decades ago where there was a chemist named Alfred Lucas who found vessels with very similar residue that you found that he concluded was not perfume or other like properties, but he couldn't conclude what it was, but he knew it was something valuable. So is it just because maybe they deemed it as something valuable, and maybe it was, like you talked before, a very like high level opium compared to maybe something like that merchants would have, or to show wealth? Or is this just something like he used it, he wanted it in his tomb with him, you know?
That's such a great question, Madeline, and I've been thinking about that because, again, human behavior, not just in antiquity, but in the more modern day, the people who studied it, like Alfred Lucas, that fascinates me, because I don't have, like, one day, if I have the time, or maybe a student has time, should go to Howard Carter's archives at the Griffith Institute and other places and do a deeper dive. I'm not an Egyptologist primarily, even though I have some Egyptological training and all that, to do that kind of deep dive. But this is what I, from hundreds of miles away, this is what I would logically say. And I kind of dance around a little bit in my article. I love the fact you picked that up, by the way, Madeline, that this King Tut, it had probably, at not probably, almost certainly, unless it was just for show, like you said, like a proxy, like the best opium, if it had opium, which I think it did. Some of the jars had, this is King Tut. We see how it's a very definition of arguably the richest tomb ever found at the height of ancient Egypt, right? The our known world, our human record of the just about the wealthiest, most powerful cultures that ever existed. So at the tail end of that height, King Tut's buried these jars, similar jars, calcite jars full of this brown stuff. The thing you got, this is where the archaeologist in me speaks. So in the 5th century, the time of Xerxes, like I said, Egypt wasn't the Egypt that we know from King Tut's era. It's the Roman Empire at the end, something like that. So empires have come and gone. They're holding on. The Persians are in control of Egypt. The logical guess is that certainly the 13th century at the height of Egypt, that opium is going to be better than the 5th century. It's not ironclad. Maybe they figured out a better like technology. Maybe they could grow it easier, just like we mass produce things now that are harder to get. So it's not a foregone conclusion, but at the minimum, I would posit it was almost certainly as good, if not better, than the 5th century stuff. With that, all that said, then that takes me away from the 18th dynasty Egypt in the late 14th century BCE, and it takes me to the early 20th century with Alfred Lucas. Yes, there could have been some technological lapses, but they didn't have gas chromatography and all that. But when you had the pure, almost certainly the purest opium, and it's not that long ago, I don't see how Alfred Lucas missed the opium. So then that got me thinking, there's a chance he maybe there's some archaeology is a rough and tumble world. Maybe they gave him the wrong sample. I mean, who knows? There's a lot of stuff that could happen. I've done that deep dive. We might never know. But it is curious that, as you know, with laudanum and stuff like that in the 19th century, opium was very much well known, morphine and all that, right? So I find it, there's something missing there. Like Alfred Lucas, even without chromatography, had to have known. So that's what got me. I didn't nuance like this in the article, but I found it fascinating that he just said, "Oh, I don't know." And I find that a little bit hard to believe. Like, well, it could also be that he didn't feel like he had the evidence. Like, again, he didn't have chromatography and all these other kind of things. He can't be like, I talked to one of the local workers and they said this is opium, something like that, or I tasted it and it's opium. I mean, like he, for whatever reason, he, I think, declined to connect those dots. Was it because of a lack of ability or technology, or was it more or something more on the ground level culturally? Or and I'll be honest, see, this is like very few chemists, if any, know this, but me having run digs, being a part of excavations, I know how excavations work. And as directors, as a dig director, it's not easy. There's so many moving parts, trying to keep a central message together. I've seen both sides. I used to complain about it when I was a specialist, saying, "Oh my gosh, like, I'm getting handcuffed." And then later on, when you're a director, you're like, "Oh my gosh, it's like herding cats." You're trying to. There's both sides to it. So that what's curious is how was Howard Carter? But 100 years ago, it was different than today. They weren't necessarily trying to control the message. Sure, Howard Carter was trying to do certain things. So what part did Howard Carter or his associates play in controlling what Alfred Lucas was presenting? There's all these factors, Madeline, and how messy archaeology can be. What I do know is, as I presented in my evidence, there are so many clues there. It's the coldest of cold cases, Madeline, right? So I'm not studying because I don't have access right now, perhaps ever, to the King Tut material. I'm studying like the people who first appeared on the crime scene, if you can call it that. Using the CSI analogy, right? From 100+ years, Howard Carter, Alfred Lucas, and I have to study their notes as best as possible. Not the original notes. I'm studying Howard Carter's final publications, right? And I quote some of those things. And my initial analysis of that is Howard Carter. He had a lot of things going on. I can only imagine. I don't think there's any. There are some people more in the tinfoil hat variety saying, "Oh my gosh, was there a conspiracy? Was he hiding something?" I mean, maybe he had some kind of Victorian sensibility and he didn't want to, broadcast that they were using opium. I mean, it might have been something simple like that, but it's nothing nefarious. But what's clear to me is that, as the quotes I made from his books, if he really wanted to bury this, he could have. Or he could have buried it more than he did. So I don't think it was that. Like he actually, as the quotes I made, from the getaway bags that were left on the stairs, he could have omitted that easily. But those bags were full of this brown stuff, right? They dropped one or two of these bags. And then the jars, you could see that the finger marks. I mean, that's when I started thinking, for me as an archaeologist, yes, you study the normal things. But I kind of, my radar goes up a little bit higher when you see really unusual or abnormal things. To see a jar with people like groping at it to take it all out. And literally, I mean, okay, maybe there was some smashing. I call it a smash and grab. How often can you use the term smash and grab? But this is one of them, right? Because we know how this works. Like, you don't rob a pharaoh's tomb unless you're gonna, get skinned alive, buried. I mean, the worst deaths possible. But we've seen them in movies, so on and so forth. So you're not gonna do that for perfumes. That's when a lot of my colleagues started agreeing, saying, "No, I agree. Like, you got to study more of these, but people aren't gonna risk what punishment could have occurred to scrape this out." And that's the other fascinating thing, as I mentioned in the article, is Howard Carter could have hid this, but or whatever, just not even drawn attention to it. And it probably would have served its purpose because even to, I mean, that's another thing that might have surprised people. And that's one of the things frequently brought up to me when people read my article is I had no idea that the tomb was actually looted because it's always presented as this pristine tomb that was never, I mean, yes, I mean, it was largely intact. But as Howard Carter mentions, two times it was looted. The first time, precious metal. So literally, people just like in minutes, smashing and grabbing. The most precious jewels, so on and so forth. That's the first looting incident. The second was just this brown stuff. And then you saw the treasures. We all saw, the world saw Howard Carter presenting these treasures. And can you imagine, like, in the list of what things to loot after the initial chaotic looting of the small jewels and things like that, which was probably unplanned. The first and only planned looting of all the things you could steal is this brown stuff. It's hard to believe that that's just perfumes or something more pedestrian. So that's what got me thinking and connected these dots.
That was Andrew Coe, a museum scientist at the Yale Peabody Museum. His research was published in the Journal of Eastern Mediterranean Archaeology. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Madeline Reynolds. If you'd like to tell the best of our knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to the best of our knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1841. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.